This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Carlson Fish Oils. Fish oil provides the vital omega-3s, EPA and DHA, which support cardiovascular, brain and nerve, vision, immune system, joint, and skin health. Carlson ensures maximum freshness by managing their fish oils from sea to shelf. All Carlson fish oils are tested by an FDA-registered laboratory for freshness, potency, and purity, and they're available in soft gels and liquid form. For more information, go to carlsonlabs.com. Carlson fish oils are available at fine health food stores nationwide.
Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and once again, it is time for our weekly Q&A with Layla, wherein we answer your most important questions that you send to us via radio program at AOL.com. And this week, we have in the mailbag a lot of your questions. But first, let me introduce my co-conspirator, Layla Mutin, Hoffman Center nutritionist, also registered dietitian, and the possessor of a master's degree in the field of nutrition. Together, we field your questions on a weekly basis. Plus, she has her own podcast, which usually appears on Fridays.
Yeah.
Correct.
For the most part, yep.
Okay. So, let's see. What's in the news before we get into questions? I thought we might spend a minute discussing a study that just came out this week. Which vindicates something that I've been doing myself for practically as long as I can remember, which is I like to exercise in the mornings.
I do too.
Yeah. You know, it's kind of like, you know, get her done and then
yes,
it's like...
Yes, otherwise it's probably not going to happen.
Yeah. I mean,
in my case.
It could happen. In some cases, it, you know, like at the end of the day, you know, maybe you're a little tired and, you know, I can motivate myself to go back to the gym after work.
Uh-huh.
And maybe refresh myself. For some people, exercising too late is not a great idea because then they get a little hyper excited.
Yes.
You know, and it may interfere with sleep. You know, so
gives them a second wind that you don't necessarily want.
Yeah. So, and you know, then the other thing is that you know, having eaten a couple of meals, if you exercise in the afternoon or evening, sometimes you feel a little weighed down. You know, perhaps you've you know, put too much in the tank.
Right.
Although, you know, certainly exercising late in the day can be a deterrent to overeating.
That's true.
And for sure, if you exercise later in the day, it's not likely you're going to have that two martini lunch, right?
Absolutely.
So for some people, maybe that works for them.
Yeah.
Plus some people, you know, let's face it, we are lucky because we have a fairly decent commute.
Yeah.
You know, I get up, you know, pretty early, but I have kind of liberal office hours. Sometimes I get a reprieve and I don't have a 9 o'clock patient.
Right.
So I have an extra hour. I can get up and I can work out. Or certainly on weekends, or before my weekly radio show, which is at noon. So usually that's on Saturdays, and Saturday mornings I'll get up and I'll have like a bout of exercise.
Yeah.
And so I exercise in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And traditionally I have exercised without putting fuel in my tank. Now, that may sound counterintuitive because some people feel like, you know, hey, if I'm going to go for a drive in my car, I'm going to check the gas tank. And, you know, I'll put a few gallons in there because my car needs fuel, right?
Right.
And certainly when you wake up in the morning, you know, you're on empty. And so you figure, hey, you know, on the car analogy, you got to put some fuel in the tank to fuel your exercise enterprise. But it doesn't really quite work out that way because the body is capable of generating energy even after a prolonged fast.
Yes.
That's why they call it break fast.
Mm-hmm.
And so this week, the American Physiological Society has vindicated my viewpoint because they did a study. And the summary of it is as follows. Exercise enthusiasts often wonder whether it's better to eat or fast before a workout. A new study is the first of its kind to show the effects of eating versus fasting on gene expression in adipose tissue, that's fat, in response to exercise. And this difference highlights the different roles fat plays in powering and responding to exercise. So, did you find this surprising?
No, not at all.
Right?
You know, you're burning more fat if you get up in the morning and exercise on an empty stomach. It's true that you will burn more fat all day doing that. You'll also burn more fat
because there's an afterburn. There's an afterburn too.
Yeah, there's an afterburn. Exactly.
You get to a little higher metabolic rate.
Right. There are people, however, that feel like they need a little something before they go to the gym. For those people, if it's going to help them get through their workout, all the better. I'm one of those people, I like to exercise in the morning because for the most part, if it doesn't occur in the morning, I'm likely not going to do it.
That's the time of the greatest rectitude and resolve is in the
morning.
And
I'm a morning person.
Yeah, okay.
I will bounce out of bed, but I'm not warm until I've eaten something or had at least a half a cup of coffee.
Oh, okay.
Soon after that, my breakfast is quite small.
Well, see, coffee doesn't count on this because coffee is a bit of an ergogenic agent.
Yeah.
And for some people, they will have a little coffee before exercise. I'd like maybe to have a half a cup of decaf, but that's just more for flavor. It could mean, you know, I could just have some water, or I could have some water with a little magnesium powder in it. Now I'm using a product called reactive magnesium.
That might be a better idea, actually.
Or, you know, I may take, you know, my dosage of niacin with that, or some red beet extract, you know, which is like beet elite or something like that, that gives me nitric oxide for exercise. But anyway, I'll show you what the people did here. At the University of Bath in the UK, they studied a group of overweight males. So I like, first of all, that they didn't do this with rats, because, like, you know, prove a lot of things in rats. You know,
it's enough. It's enough with the rats.
Yeah, it's enough with the rats, because the rats aren't people, with certain exceptions.
Right.
So the volunteers walked for 60 minutes at 60% maximum oxygen consumption on an empty stomach, or, alternatively, 2 hours after consuming a high-calorie, carbohydrate-rich breakfast. So it's like a carbo load. So, you know, 60 minutes is a substantial amount of exercise. And the research, and they didn't look so much at, you know, how they felt. They didn't talk about that. They didn't talk about exercise performance either, which is interesting. You know, what, did they perform better or worse? But what they looked at is specific gene activity. And now we're getting to the weeds a little bit. The expression of two genes, PDK4 and HSL. I never heard of those, I'll confess. They increased when the men fasted and exercised, and decreased when they ate before exercising. Now, what's significant about those two, you know, alphabet soup genes, is that they have to do with fat burning. So, basically, what they're saying is the exercise turned on the fat burning, and having the carbohydrates suppress the fat burning, which is logical.
Right.
Because if you have nothing in your stomach, and you're looking for fuel, you're going to go to your fat stores to derive the fuel.
Right.
And if
Unless you have enough glycogen to burn up first.
But it's not likely you're going to have that much glycogen after an eight-hour sleep.
That's true.
You know, your glycogen stores disappear after a fast. So I think one of the things that training effect does is it allows you to store more glycogen. Maybe I'm storing some glycogen better because I'll eat, you know.
But not that much more. There's just not that much room for glycogen.
Yeah.
Even
it's in your liver.
Athletes.
It's in your liver and in your muscles.
Yeah.
But doesn't it go away like 4 or 6 hours, something like that?
Yeah, half a day,
so
tops.
So what I'm burning, so, you know, what we all want to be is we want to be a lean, mean, fat-burning machine, right? And, you know, this doesn't speak to exercise performance, which is another thing. But I got to say, I don't experience a bonk if I don't eat, unless I go for a longer period. So let's say I'm going to double, you know, usually my exercise feats don't last more than a couple hours. But if, like, somebody says, hey, let's go for a 50, 60-mile bike ride. I'm going to carbo load a little before that.
Yeah. And or maybe, stop after five.
And maybe take
nibble.
A bottle of something that has some carbohydrate. For example, the Ironman contestants who go for like 8, 9, 10, 12, 13 hours.
Take some raisins.
They have, it's a science how they rehydrate and replenish because they hit the wall numerous times during that event. You know, they can't store enough from, you know, without eating before. Or even if they have breakfast, they still need to refuel because they're burning down calories.
So that's interesting. I have to say, with exception of when I used to run in the morning, that I can't eat anything. That will just come back up. You have to go for a run on an empty stomach.
Right.
So that would be the exception to any other kind of exercise. It's also great not to do yoga. You also don't want to do yoga on a full stomach.
Exactly.
Because with all the down dog and everything, things are just going to regurgitate.
You know, you know what's nice about yoga too is that yoga is a great deterrent to overeating. Because when you really are in touch with your stomach contents, you know, when you do these inversions and planks and contortions, and your breathing is affected too by a full stomach. So I think that yoga would be a good, have an afternoon yoga session, then you're going to eat lightly during the day.
Probably.
Because you're not going to have a big honking, Reuben sandwich, at lunch, and then at 4:30 try and do your yoga. That's not going to work well.
I think yoga works in more ways than we're able to actually express. I think a lot of it has to do with the autonomic nervous system.
Yes.
To some degree.
Yeah.
Something happens when you're doing those poses, those asanas. This is my experience, you just become so present, just so here and now. And we go through our lives and we're not. Mm-hmm. We're here thinking about the next thing. Oh, what am I going to cook for dinner tonight? Or what's going to happen tomorrow?
And, I'm going to admit that my moments of presence during yoga are few and far between.
Oh,
much
really?
Of my time during yoga is, I'm tremulous, this hurts, I'm straining.
Oh, okay.
I know that's counter to the spirit of yoga, but I'm just a novice.
Yeah,
And I totally
come back to your breath.
I totally get where I need to go, but I'm, as a novice, it's still not a Zen-like pure state the whole time.
There's just something so different about it, for me anyway, that it just calms everything down. I know there, back when Oprah Winfrey used to have her show and they were talking about yoga one day, and these women's, their lives completely changed once they took up yoga. They stopped overeating. They stopped obsessing. They stopped this and they stopped that. Mm-hmm. And they stopped being shopaholics. Something happens, and I think it's quite wonderful. It's
good.
That therapeutic.
And how long have you been doing it?
I started doing this when I was in college, the second time I went to college.
Oh, wow.
So in my 30s.
Okay, well.
Really.
Okay, so there's hope for me?
Absolutely.
Because I've been doing it for about 6 months, if that.
It takes a lot of training to not think.
Yeah.
And just become a witness, to pull, zoom out, so to speak, and be a witness to you thinking and not fight it. You're not fighting it.
Okay.
You're letting it be.
Something
whole other
to aspire
podcast.
To. So let's be present in the moment and let's answer questions.
Yes. Now that you brought me back.
Right.
We have an email from Michael. Dear Dr. Hoffman, I was listening to your podcast, your interview with Dr. Kara Fitzgerald, who talked about methylation. How do you know how much food and or supplements to take so that one is not over-methylating or under-methylating?
Right.
And, I heard Dr. Fitzgerald mention several foods, and particularly supplement components, that actually regulate the rate of methylation, like quercetin, cruciferous vegetables, all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how do you know if you're over-methylating or under-methylating?
Okay, so let's even explain the concept of methylation.
Right.
Methylation, comes from what are called methyl donors, and methyl donors include certain of the activated B vitamins like methylcobalamin and methylfolate and B6 in whatever form, pyridoxin or P5P.
Yeah.
But also choline and dimethylglycine, or actually trimethylglycine, TMG, otherwise known as betaine, tend to be methyl donors.
Mm-hmm.
And you need those.
Yes.
Because methylation both turns on certain things and turns off certain things. So the concern is, you want to turn on helpful pathways for neurotransmitters in your brain, for example, and for growth and repair and for metabolism. But you also don't want to turn on certain pathways that, say, promote cancer.
Yes.
Or you don't want to turn off certain pathways that inhibit cancer.
Mm-hmm.
So it's complicated. It's a yin and yang.
Right.
And, so I got, in hopes that I would get some kind of definitive answer, I got Kara Fitzgerald on, who is one of the most authoritative people on the subject of methylation.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a little surprised, but also very delighted that she herself professes some degree of, I would say confusion, but some humbleness to the concept of what's optimal methylation. And it's not just a matter of taking some supple methyl donor supplement, mega dosing folate, taking 25 milligrams of, 25 milligrams of folate, which would be 25, you can get 5 milligrams, 20 milligrams, 25.
Yeah.
You can get these mega doses.
A lot, yeah.
So Is there a possibility that you will over-methylate? Well, some studies criticize even the use of folic acid supplements in grains because we may be over-methylating our population.
Right, right.
Well, on the one hand, we prevent neural tube defects, but are we increasing the risk of cancer? Well, that's not been demonstrated. It's more theoretical.
Yes.
So what she's proposed is do all these healthy things, which you should do anyway. Eat really a balanced diet that's has a lot of plant components, which are rich in B vitamins, but also don't ignore the animal sources of B vitamins.
Right.
If you see a problem like high homocysteine, okay, take some methyl donors to lower your homocysteine.
Mm-hmm.
But she talks about this as a methylation lifestyle rather than precision medicine where you can take a test and see whether you're over-methylated or you're under-methylated. Because you could be in one pathway over-methylated and another pathway under-methylated, since so many bodily functions are methyl-dependent, methylation-dependent.
Yes.
So, there's no metric for that.
Right. And how we're methylating is also dependent on other things, other medical conditions with regard to... I remember one particular webinar that I saw recently on Hashimoto's thyroiditis that it could actually downregulate MTHFR.
Okay.
That particular SNP,
mm-hmm.
which is responsible for undermethylating.
In a hypothyroid condition, you may be undermethylating.
Exactly. Okay. So even when we all found out about
hormones,
MTHFR,
exercise,
all kinds of things. Exactly. Mm-hmm. It's a big forest here.
Yeah.
It's not just one tree mm-hmm. or one gene mm-hmm. that's being impacted.
And pollutants can affect methylation for
Absolutely.
Sure.
Absolutely.
So if you damage some of your methylation pathways with, say, mercury.
Yeah.
They propose like a lot of folate for autistic kids to boost that faulty methylation.
Right.
But
right.
maybe their faulty methylation is due to, vaccines or due to mercury or aluminum from vaccines.
Another big topic.
It's complicated. Nobody knows the answer. And
right.
I know that, people who are, precision oriented in their professions who are, following this intelligent medicine, almost look to it as there should be more precision.
Mm.
And as I'm very close to the field, I have to recognize in humbleness that we don't know all the answers yet, that I read many papers, sometimes contradicting one another. And
is this path of precision that's now happening with so many integrative practitioners, is this just another form of specialization,
mm-hmm.
being maybe possibly a little less holistic
right.
by being too focused on precision rather than, that's interesting.
Sort of taking that 20,000 foot altitude view of healthy lifestyle
right.
and, just optimizing diet and lifestyle.
I remember when Ben Lynch, who was one of the foremost people, biochemists who talked about methylation and uncovered the whole pathway and the SNPs, when he then there were people who were coming back and having symptoms of taking methylcobalamin,
sure.
for example. They were having anxiety or mm-hmm. they were having some other kind of emotional upset.
They may not have a COMT. They
exactly.
have a COMT mutation, which...
Right.
So it gets complicated. It's there.
There so it's
may
not
be,
just about
you may be over-revving something that another gene impacts.
Right.
It's complicated.
It is complicated.
But,
so
I like her concept of the methylation lifestyle.
Yeah.
And if you want, Google Kara Fitzgerald and mm-hmm. listen to the podcast I did with her. And I think she has an ebook on methylation that is probably very helpful.
Terrific, Michael. Yeah. Thank you for your question. Okay. And we always get a question on bone health at this point. It's become pretty common.
Okay.
Hi, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. I am, let's see, do I have a name here? No. I'm a 70-year-old woman in fairly good physical condition. My first DEXA scan just taken shows a spine at, she means negative 2.4, hip at negative 2.3, and wrist, negative 2.6. I don't know why they bother with the wrist. Of course, my doctor wants to put me on medication. I started taking Ostera, and I take extra vitamin D as well. Do I need to pull the trigger with strontium?
Pull the trigger.
Or can I wait to see if Ostera moves the numbers in the right direction?
It's not such a big deal. flashing forward to a question, you know, I know we're about 3 or 4 weeks behind in the cycle in terms of the mailbag.
Yeah.
There was another question that was just sent to us by someone who had done precisely that, had taken Ostera and had not seen the requisite improvement in their bone density.
Yeah.
And because I think it's part and parcel of what you need to do. Ostera has hops extract, it's anti-inflammatory, but in and of itself, it's probably not sufficient. So
yes.
This is a person who could take strontium.
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
you know, wait a couple of years and see if the bone density improves. And then the wolves won't be baying at her door with
right.
need to take medication.
Exactly. And have your vitamin D levels checked, as everybody should.
Other things that are helpful, vitamin K, obviously.
Yeah. Vitamin K, magnesium.
And we use a combo product that has boron and I think it has a perflavone.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Osteoprive.
Yes.
With bioavailable calcium. And another thing that's helpful for those who don't take strontium, or if in the rare instances where strontium doesn't do the trick, is Ostanol.
Mm.
And I reserve Ostanol sometimes for...
fracture.
For fracture or for
severe.
Hard cases, because it's a little expensive. It's a little expensive. But
yeah.
I did have a very interesting case of a woman who said, for some reason, she didn't respond to strontium or didn't want to take strontium, something.
Mm-hmm.
And she just took Ostanol, and she showed me before and after, and with just Ostanol, there were improvements.
Wonderful.
Significant improvements.
Bone morphogenetic protein.
BMP.
Mm-hmm. BMP. Wonderful, wonderful. So, there's a place for you to start. Okay, and strength training.
And strength training.
Yeah. Push-ups and squats.
And actually, I posted on Facebook, and I know you don't follow Facebook, just a deliberate lifestyle choice so that you don't get deranged by all that. Those cat videos. But I posted on my Facebook 12 exercises that are helpful for yoga positions that are helpful for osteoporosis.
Wonderful.
Yeah. So weight-bearing positions that could mm-hmm. make a difference.
Mm-hmm. People don't realize that yoga is a very strengthening exercise. And there are ways to modify positions, too, if you're, say, a senior or who has mobility issues or anything like that. All of it can be modified,
mm-hmm.
which is a good thing. Okay. Oh, we have an email from Edward. Dr. Hoffman, any way to restore my sense of taste and smell? Oh, wow.
That could be a tough reach. A couple of things that have been proposed, but I find are rather weak. Phosphatidylcholine, in some mm-hmm. cases, has been helpful, and zinc can be helpful.
Zinc.
But only if you have a real zinc deficiency, because lack of zinc can cause loss of taste. But most people who are walking around in America don't have such profound zinc deficiency that they're losing
That's
their true. Taste. Why does one lose taste? Well, certainly it's like aging,
mm-hmm.
okay? It could be in the nerves, in which case alpha-lipoic acid may be helpful.
Mm-hmm.
There is a little bit of a disturbing link between loss of taste and smell, and risk of Alzheimer's disease. Although, it's sort of a tenuous link, and there's so many people who have loss of taste and smell that's not related to that it's
mm-hmm.
it's hardly worth getting people worried about that.
I've heard of some people mention, I took this nose spray or I took this medicine and I don't smell anymore.
Exactly. Well,
can't taste anymore.
So antibiotics will often do it.
Sure.
And steroids will do it.
Steroid nose sprays, too, I believe,
cause
that problem.
Nerve damage.
Yeah, yeah. And the reason for the taste buds to go away is our sense of taste is 75% olfactory.
Olfactory, right.
Sense of smell. I thought I was saying it backwards.
Right.
But I would like to know how old Edward is, but
mm-hmm.
Or if he's been on any medication lately, particularly antibiotics, and maybe that's contributing. Or if he just had a bad cold and maybe is still feeling the remnants of that.
That's another thing, is that after a virus, you can have a residual loss.
Yeah.
And sometimes long-term and permanent loss.
Mm. Yeah. Zinc is also helpful in those with eating disorders, anorexia in particular, because some of it is blamed on a lack of taste buds, which may be caused by a zinc deficiency, which is caused by not eating. And very interesting.
Yeah, challenging problem. All right, so let us pause, because we divide our podcast into two parts, and give us a preview of what we're going to tackle in part two.
Okay. There are so many varieties of magnesium over the year that you've discussed. How do I know which one to take?
All right. We will address that pressing issue when we return. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, today with Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mutin, and this is our weekly Q&A with Layla.